first thing we noticed, only after living in the wilderness, that is, hey. So in the bush, we only see animals, basically. Well, the odd human, but a lot of animals. And I always notice how healthy every single animal is. How agile and strong, and they run across the mountain, especially those tar and chamois in there, and hares. And then coming to town, I think, wow, everyone is so unhealthy.
You're listening to the Untaming Podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily, and this is the Untaming Podcast. Today it is the full flower moon here in the Southern Hemisphere, and this is episode 48. I hope you enjoyed the last episode with Dr. Ainsley Rowan on baby containers, tummy time, car seats, and pooping positions. The next episode to come out on the 28th of November to coincide with the last quarter of the flower moon is with a return guest, Peter Michael Bauer. He and I did a two-parter last year on agriculture and education. This time we talked more about defining rewilding, understanding taxes, dismantling civilization, becoming ungovernable, and how to lessen our dependency on the state. But today we have Miriam Lancewood. This was a really fun chat. I loved hearing the perspective of someone who not just lives off-grid, but has lived for an extended period of time literally in the wilderness, and not that far from where I live right now. Thirty-eight-year-old Miriam Lancewood was born in a loving home in a village in the Netherlands. After completing her university degree, she worked for a year in Zimbabwe, then travelled to India where she met her now husband, Peter. Together, they hiked over 8 mountain ranges in the Himalaya, journeyed for years through Southeast Asia, including Papua New Guinea, and eventually they ended up in Peter's home country, New Zealand. Miriam worked for a while as a teacher, then they decided to give up all their worldly belongings and move into the mountains with a tent and bow and arrow. They wanted to learn how to survive in the wilderness and find out what happens to body and mind when living in the beauty of the wildest nature on earth. Miriam's memoir, Women in the Wilderness, became an international bestseller and was translated into 5 languages. Her second book, Wild at Heart, came out last year. Last night, Miriam had 11 hours of sleep, and for breakfast this morning, she had yogurt from a cow in her nearby village. Miriam, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great.
So I read your book, Women in the Wilderness, a couple of months ago, and as soon as I finished it, I emailed you asking for an interview because there were so many things I wanted to talk to you about and share here on the podcast. Mm-hmm. As I said in your biography, you and your husband, Peter, moved into the mountains with a tent and a bow and arrow. For the listeners who haven't yet read your book, there were a few different ways that you did this. Can you give us like a rough description of the different conditions that you lived in and with what supplies during those years living in the New Zealand wilderness?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll explain. Yeah. That so I met Peter in India. We did a lot of adventures and we had years and years of travel done together. And then we went to New Zealand and I had to work as a physical education teacher. Mm-hmm. So during that year, I was pretty bored and was sort of looking forward to a new adventure. So then we said to each other, what shall we do next? Think of something, you know, remarkable. And we said to each other, maybe we should do 4 seasons in the wilderness. Wouldn't that be cool? Mm. And so for a starter, we just had in mind 4 seasons, just 1 year. So we went into the bush with a bow and arrow and a bit of rice and flour in that as well. Yeah. And I learned how to hunt in that first year. After the first year, we thought, right, what shall we do next? So we wanted to do every year something different because otherwise it gets boring, I think. So 1 year, for example, we bought a Toyota Hilux Surf and we traveled the whole back country. For example, we went far, far up a certain river and then stayed there for 3 months. Another year, we walked the Te Araroa Trail, which is everyday walking, very different from sitting in one place. So in that way, we had a lot of variety in places and ways of living. But in the end, it was 7 years.
Yep. Wow. And the Te Araroa Trail, for the listeners who don't know, is from like the top of the South Island all the way to the bottom of the... Sorry, from the top of the North Island to the bottom of the South Island of New Zealand.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now we mentioned the bow and arrow implying hunting, yet up until this point, you were a lifelong vegetarian. Can you tell us about the switch to an omnivorous diet?
Yeah, so my mother never cooked meat because she believed it wasn't very healthy and full of hormones and not very good industry, etc. And so I believed the same. Then I came to New Zealand and I learned about the ecological problems with the introduced animals. And I saw that it's actually ethically better to eat wild meat than imported lentils from India, say.
Yeah.
So then we had the idea to survive in the wilderness. And I thought, right, I'm going to learn how to hunt, because I always was very fond of Robin Hood. And I want to run around with a bow and arrow. It's a very idyllic picture.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. Yeah. And then I learned how to shoot on a target for a year when we were living near Blenheim.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went out. So the hunting was completely part of this survival idea of ours, right?
Yeah.
And but it was very traumatic to kill the first animal. And then I thought, wow, why are we actually doing this? We are contributing to the suffering of animals. For what reason? Just to play Robin Hood or Adam and Eve in their wilderness, you know? It felt very ridiculous all of a sudden. But after eating the meat, suddenly, because we set out in May, so it got very quickly very cold, after eating meat, we were for the first time not cold during the night, and we didn't wake up with hunger pains like the other mornings.
Wow.
Yeah.
So was it quite a mental leap for you, like, I guess, taking that first bite?
First bite? No, well, especially taking the first hit on the possum's head.
Yeah.
Because I also always thought of, you know, meat eaters, you know, it's not good. It's pretty evil to eat meat.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly I was one of them.
Yeah.
I was the one killing animals, you know. And so suddenly I could not call myself good anymore. And I think that moral adjustment was the biggest thing. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And so you were saying, what was it? You spent about a year when you were living outside Blenheim practicing with a target. So was this your entire experience using the bow and arrow?
Yeah. And I set myself up with a target. I stood on 25 meters in the backyard, so very flat. And after a year, I practiced every day, 30 arrows. I needed a lot of discipline for that. Practicing is really boring. Yeah. Anyway, I did it.
Yeah.
And in the end, I was very good. And I was very good at grouping, you know, putting the arrows in the same place. And I thought, ah. And I said to a friend who was a bow hunter, I said, oh, I'm very good at and the archery, so how difficult can it be? And he said, you will see. And I always remember those words, because it was so difficult and so different from practicing on the target in the backyard.
Yeah.
Hunting is a totally different kettle of fish. Yeah.
So you had quite, because I've read your book and I know that you had quite a few attempts before you actually got an animal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, a couple of years into your adventure, you switched to using a gun. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I did notice that sometimes I would miss the animal, a lot of the times, with my bow and arrow, and I would lose the arrows. Now, every arrow costs $15, and I thought, well, you could find them, but it's very hard in the high grass.
Yeah.
So I spent hours and hours looking for arrows. And if you hit a stone or something, then the arrow head is broken.
Mm.
So all in all, it's a very costly way to hunt. Moreover, I often would hunt, hurt the animal, just wounded.
Mm.
And then the animal would run away bleeding and, oh, terrible, really terrible. Mm. So I feel most horrible when I just wound the animal and I can't find it anymore. And then it dies slowly over 4 days. It's terrible.
Yeah.
So then my friend introduced me to gun hunting and bang, dead. So it's much more humane to go gun hunting.
Yeah.
As long as you're accurate, of course.
Yeah, of course.
So I switched to a 22, which is a very small bullet. Mm-hmm. And because of my difficulty or experience with bow hunting, the gun hunting was very easy for me. So, yeah, so much more successful, and every bullet is like 10 cents.
Oh, cool. And so you hadn't done any target practice with a gun prior to this, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I thought that was a waste of a bullet.
Yeah.
But just because I bow hunted for 2 years, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was relatively easy.
Yeah. And do you still use the bow at all now?
Yes, I've got it here. So at the moment we are in Bulgaria. And I've got again a target, and I practice again on the target.
Yeah, cool. So in your book, you noted that your eyesight improved with hunting. So yeah, I'd like to hear more about this.
Yeah, I think whatever you do, your body adjusts. So mm-hmm. if you spend all day in front of the computer, you become very good at short distance looking.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you go hunting, you have to train your eyes to look in a distance. Mm-hmm. And to look at movement and color. And yes, over the years, I noticed my senses improved. My hearing became better, my nose, my eyes, and also a sense of intuition. Because if you don't have a feel of where the animals are, you can walk for days without seeing anything.
Yeah. And because you did the... You were the sole hunter. Peter didn't do the hunting with you. Did he notice an improvement in his eyesight despite not hunting, simply from just being outside, you know, almost permanently and surveying
the surroundings? That's right, actually. You're right. I never thought of it. But his eyesight also became better. Yeah.
Oh, right. Oh, cool.
And he still doesn't need reading glasses. He's already 68 now. He's one of the few people I know that doesn't need reading glasses.
Wow, that's really good to hear. And like, I'm sure the listeners are thinking, oh, that's a good way to avoid it.
Yeah.
Spend more time outside.
Yeah, that's right.
So now I want to get more into what you were talking before about your senses being heightened. But before we do, I'm curious about the nutritional staples that you relied upon that you took in with you. Like you said before, like taking in some lentils and some flour. What else did you take in? Why did you select these specific foods?
Well, as I said, every year we did something different. So depending on what we did, we took the required food. So when you're walking every day, you want to have everything as light as possible. Generally so. Like you don't take bread, for instance. We just take flour, right, to bake bread. But when we went into the bush the first time, we took our big camp oven, which is already 10 kilos or so. But of course, we don't take that one in the backpack when we walk Tiaroa.
Yeah.
So, depends a little bit. But, so we rely on the hunting. So we have meat there and the fat. And so we basically always take flour and lentils and beans. Beans, especially in winter when we sit around the fire anyway all day, because they take so long to cook, you see.
True.
Yeah, that. And then we drink Manuka tea and we gather as much berries and fruit that we can get.
Cool. And are there any foods that you didn't think of until you were actually in the wilderness that you wish you'd taken?
No. I can't think of anything.
No, you guys had prepared heavily beforehand.
Yeah, we all had it worked out very well. In the beginning, the first year, we took a lot of dried fruit and nuts as well.
Mm-hmm.
But after that, we didn't anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, so actually, we cut down a lot. Yeah. And another thing was, when we first went out, I thought, okay, it's going to be really cold. So I made myself, from a woolen blanket in the op shop, I made myself a ski trousers. You know those things that come up to your chest, sort of a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Like long trousers and all the way up, and to keep my back and tummy warm. That was the idea. But when I tried it, when I put it on in the winter in the bush, I noticed how difficult it was if you have to take a pee. Because then you have to take off your jacket and your jumper and your merino jumper. And where do you leave that? You know, in the snow?
Yeah.
And then take off that thing in order to take a pee. So those sort of things we found out is very impractical. Yeah, so we did store those. Mm.
Cool. How much more difficult do you think it would have been to try to live in the wilderness without taking in any of those staples? Do you think it would have even been possible to survive purely on your own knowledge of foraging and hunting?
Yeah, well, that I experimented with on my expedition a couple of years ago with a friend.
Right, yeah.
And we did 3 months walk from Arthur's Pass towards Wanaka, over 8 mountain ranges or so, with nothing, only rods and rifles. And we became very, very thin. And that's another whole story altogether. But it would be very difficult. Yeah. And Peter would say, why would you do it? Just take some rice and flour. But I wanted to do this as an experiment. But yeah. I think in New Zealand, it would be very difficult. Here in Europe, however, is so much fruit trees and nut trees and so much more to eat. So that would be easier in summer and autumn. Maybe not in winter and spring.
Yeah. And I imagine in New Zealand, a lot of our animals have been, the ones that you were hunting anyway, they were the ones that had been introduced with like European colonization.
Yeah,
so
all of them.
If you didn't have those, I guess what would you have been subsisting on? Mostly just seafood?
Oh, you mean what the Maoris would have done?
Yeah.
Yeah, they lived always on the seaside.
Mm.
Yeah. Some places high in the mountains, the Maoris never been or have not named any river or creek or something or mountaintop. Yeah, so they lived on the seaside and I understand very well because that's where the food is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so and what you were saying before about your journey that you did with your with another friend, that is the content of your second book, is that right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Now, going back to what you were saying about the difference in senses and like the improvement in your eyesight, there were many other sort of changes you mentioned in the book that you experienced from living in the wilderness that I'm really interested in hearing more about. Firstly, could you tell us about your perception? Because you mentioned that before, and like awareness of things like bird language.
Oh, yeah. So when you live very, very quietly in the wild, then that nothing happens. For a starter, nothing happens except the weather changes, right? So then after a while, you start to notice that how the birds are communicating. And if there is any danger, they would call out. Or if there is any food, they would call out. So, especially paradise ducks are very famous for the call of danger. And the other one is always saying, nah, calm down, calm down. So in the end, I started making also the same sound of calm down, calm down. Because I don't want those paradise ducks to raise the alarm. Because there might be a rabbit nearby that I want to shoot. And everyone is listening to everything. So the hares and rabbits are also listening for, oh, the birds are saying something is coming. So they'd be more on their guard, you see. So everything is communicating. Yeah, and what we noticed after a while is that actually we humans are also animals. And if animals look at us, they would say, oh, this is just humans with a funny skin.
Very true. And something I think many people would struggle with is boredom and restlessness and that need that we have in mainstream society to be constantly busy. And I think you wrote that this was something especially challenging for you and Peter to work through. So could you talk us through it?
Yeah. I think if I look at myself back in Holland, where I was born, I left Holland when I was 21, but stressful time for me, school, university, sports, all that. And very much programmed, I think, like everyone else, to keep busy and to keep improving myself and to make a better version of myself and learn more and do more. And consequently, we are conditioned to believe that boredom is something, one, total waste of time, and secondly, something horrible. And that's what I discovered in the bush when there was nothing to do. And my mind was very fast. Because, just coming out of town and a lot of friends and a lot of social gatherings and all the rest of it. And I had to slow down. And that took about 2 weeks before my mind meets the rhythm of nature. And in those 2 weeks, I experienced severe boredom. And then it feels so uncomfortable And then I think, why does it feel so uncomfortable? Why? It doesn't hurt. It's not like physical pain. And yet it's so deeply conditioned, I discovered. And so I talked about it with Peter and he said, yeah, you have to learn the art of doing nothing. That you just slow down and do nothing for a bit. And that goes right against all our programming of doing more and more and more and more. So, it took about 2 weeks. And then I realized most people go on holiday for only 2 weeks, you know. And you need to sit through it in order to totally relax and for your senses to become better and to become, more zen and more calm down. And you get more clarity after a while because your mind is not so full and racing around like a roundabout, you know. Not efficiently, just go around. So I think it's very healthy and I would recommend everyone to do just that, sit through boredom. But who wants to?
So what did you do in those 2 weeks? Like, how did you, when you were feeling so bored, like how did you manage it?
I sit near the river or so and see movement, that sort of helps. Mm-hmm. Sit around the fire, that helps. Mm-hmm, and just sit and just actively try to observe other things. Hunting in itself is very calming down activity, actually. So I often go sit on the edge of the forest and look out, look at the edge where all the animals would come out in twilight. You have to have a lot of patience.
Yeah. So yeah, I like your advice that everybody should try and have at least 2 weeks, if not more, of getting through that boredom and restlessness.
Yeah, the first 2 weeks are not much fun, but after it's good.
Now, how did you stay clean?
It's really funny. We're in the wilderness, I feel very clean. When we stay with friends in their houses, I always think, oh, God, so dirty. Not that their houses are dirty, not at all. We have very clean friends. But it's just that... I sort of feel like in this closed-in house, the wind doesn't get through. The rain doesn't clean it. Anyway, so after a while, I feel very clean in the mountains. Yeah, but every time it's warm, I would take a wash in the river. So when it's cold and wet, we don't wash and we stay just dry and try to get not too dirty.
Yeah. And what about washing your hair?
With urine, you mean?
yeah.
Yeah, so the story goes that in my first winter, I had a problem with dandruff. And Peter said, you know, those Inuit people, they used to wash their hair with morning urine. Could give it a try because I didn't have any special shampoo or anything, you see. So I peed in a tin and... wet my hair first, then poured the urine over my hair, then waited 20 minutes, and then washed it out with soap. And it works really well. I could recommend it.
Yeah. And what? You never needed to do it again after that?
Never again. So I did it once, but in the media, it's now portrayed as though I do it every day, but it's not the case. I did it once.
You did it once like over 5 years ago and it's still being brought up.
Yeah, 10 years ago now. Yeah.
Ten years ago. Okay. What about your sleeping? How did your sleep patterns change by being outside so much?
Well, we set out in May, in the first winter, and so it was very early dark and, of course, we didn't have any light. We didn't have a clock. So that was the whole thing. For all the 7 years or 10 years, actually, we didn't have a clock with us. No cell phone or nothing like that. No GPS, no emergency beacon. So we had absolutely no idea what time it was. But we reasoned that in winter it's earlier dark than summer. But strangely enough, this is not so obvious when you're in it. Like if you would look at the clock, you'd think, what? It's only 6 o'clock. We don't go to bed. But if it's dark, your brain says, oh, I'm getting tired. Let's go to sleep. We just slept automatically when it's dark. And the first winter, I slept so much. And we concluded that this is really very healthy, that you clean your entire body by sleeping 11 hours a night, one whole winter. And then, of course, in summer, way, way less. And so we feel sleep deprived in summer. because we sleep when it's dark. So I think the biggest curse of humanity is electricity. If it wasn't for electricity, we would sleep much more. It would be much healthier.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing was that we took one book with us, Lord of the Rings. And of course, we couldn't read it together. So Peter was reading it to me, which reminded me of being a kid. But anyway, he started reading and I noticed that it took about 3 or 4 weeks before I could listen properly. My mind was just drifting off. And I thought, well, that's weird. As a child, I could listen easily. And but after 4 weeks, I could finally follow the whole chapter. Isn't that crazy?
Whoa. So wait, do you think this has to do with more your, that calming down of your restlessness? Or do you think? Oh, okay. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, you try it. You try it if someone reads out a book.
Yeah.
A podcast is a little bit more engaging, but just like, you know, a book. And someone is reading to you and your thoughts are, you know, drifting off.
Yes. Oh, my thoughts absolutely drift off when I'm like listening to something. That, so, that's okay. I need to spend longer outside in the wilderness.
About 4 weeks.
At least. So now you've had occasion to re-enter society. In the book, it was sometimes just for a few days and then sometimes for months while you were dealing with bureaucracy. But I'm curious to hear more about the differences or difficulties you noticed upon re-entering civilization, both in yourselves and in the people around you who haven't had that chance to get through their restlessness or are sleep deprived or, the same sort of thing, haven't had the experiences you have.
Yeah, indeed. Well, first thing we noticed, only after living in the wilderness, that is, so in the bush, we only see animals, basically. Well, the odd human, but a lot of animals. And I always notice how healthy every single animal is, how agile and strong, and they run across the mountain, especially those tar and chamois in there, and hares. And then coming to town, I think, wow, everyone is so unhealthy. The way they walk is not... like one shoulder would be lower than the other, or one leg looks shorter than the other. You know what I mean? Like disfigured. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really weird, considering we're actually animals, right?
Yeah.
And that I noticed. So I suddenly noticed how people are not walking, how would you say that?
Upright.
In a normal way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also what you mentioned, sleep deprived. Almost everyone looks sleep deprived. So I kept saying, sleep more. But it's very difficult because in town, of course, the electricity is on and my brain is not tired. In fact, it's just hyperactive in the evening. Yeah. So I don't sleep either. And then I get more tired. And then in the morning, I wake up feeling tired and I compensate this with eating more and especially eating more sugar. So I see immediately my eating habit change when I don't sleep well. Yeah.
Wow.
And then I feel bloated. And the solution then seems to be to eat more. It's totally irrational. But my whole eating pattern is out of kilter when I am living in a city with all the busyness and electricity and lights and screens. Yeah. And, also people seem to be, worried about things that you don't need to worry about. It's not a problem. And people seem to be focused on it. So our state of mind is always focused, which is the opposite of saying a state of mind that is like a hunter who is just alert, right? It's looking everywhere. So you have to have an open mind in order to see a hare that might be either on your right side or on your left side. Yeah. So it's not focused like digging a hole in the ground. You know, you see what I mean? Yeah,
yes,
and our state of mind is a little bit scientific, like always focusing on one problem. And if the one problem is solved, next one. Yeah.
And once you were back for like a little while, did you start to notice yourself experiencing the same sort of things as those people around you, like starting to feel more worried? Yeah, totally.
So I've become, I'm not at all different for anyone else. I'm exactly the same. And sometimes I think, would I be able to live back in society with a 9-to-5 job? And then I think, no, I would also have a burnout and get depressed. Yeah, I think we become, we are different people in a different situation. So I think if you feel depressed or unhealthy, put yourself in a different place and then you become healthy again.
And in your book, you wrote about the changes you noticed in like your menstrual cycle.
Yes, after some time, I noticed that with a full moon, I would get a period. Yeah, so the body is adjusting and getting aligned again with nature. Yeah, and like the senses and all those abilities that we have seemed to have forgotten.
Yeah, and then once you were back in like living in the town, did it change again?
Yep, back again.
Yeah,
to all over the place. Yep.
That's interesting, especially for anyone who, you know, wants to track their fertility. And it's like, well, hang on, maybe this is the reason why everything's all over. Yeah. And so you spoke about your nutritional needs, about craving more sugars. Is there anything else, like, because you would have been eating a lot of fat from the animals to see you through the winters especially. Did this change, like, your cravings for these sort of foods or meats or things like that?
Oh, we really noticed summer and winter. So in the summer, also because we have to calculate the food that we need, in the winter, we eat 1/3 more. Isn't that amazing? Wow. Yeah, so we had one. So we started off in winter, remember? And so we had the same supplies for summer, and we had so much left over.
Whoa.
Yeah, we ate so much less. So it's very natural to eat more carbohydrates, more fat in winter. Yeah, to keep warm, of course.
Yeah. And so that's like you need more food and more sleep in winter, less food and less sleep in summer.
Yeah, indeed.
And what about your energy levels once you'd been back in town? I'm assuming you didn't drink coffee or anything like that when you were out in the wilderness. Did you start to drink it when you were in town?
Yeah, because I got so tired. And I think, oh, may as well have coffee. And of course, I always go a little bit overboard with everything. So I drink too much coffee, admittingly. But then I get the shakes and I have to sit down and drink water. And it's no good. Everything seems out of kilter. So I have to find a balance. And so right now we are in Bulgaria, as I mentioned. And I cannot hunt here because of the there's no hunting license possible for me as a foreigner. But and I noticed we are still a little bit in the feast and famine mode, that we find it difficult to remind ourselves that, you know, we can also eat a little bit tomorrow. We don't have to eat it all today. So I think it's quite natural to us humans to just overeat. But the difference is that people in town, there is never a famine. It's always enough food. Yeah.
True. And I'm curious about things like social etiquette. Do you know, are there social practices that you find utterly absurd and, you know, you roll your eyes when you think, oh, yes, I have to behave like this again?
Yeah, clothing, that what you look like is clothing. It's a bit absurd.
Yes.
Especially clothing that is so so uncomfortable. Like a shirt, for instance, in the winter, and your shirt is too high, and your kidneys are exposed to the cold air. That's actually very unhealthy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, and people don't even take that into account.
Indeed. And also the obsession with time that you have to. It's very normal and it's very practical, but we have lived for so long without watches. That being on a certain time seems rather ridiculous. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also another very funny thing, that when we arrived, we're walking in Bulgaria, described in the second Wild at Heart. that we came into a village that hardly ever saw foreigners or anyone really. And they looked at us with a frown. And I thought, at first, oh, wow, how unfriendly these people are. And then I realized they are not used to looking in the mirror all the time, and they don't realize what they look like.
Huh.
Yeah, so they...
So I was going to say, you'd think that they'd see just the looks on the people's faces around them.
Yeah, indeed. But they didn't realize that that makes a very unfriendly impression. But they were just surprised. And they're like, what's that? People coming out of the forest in the middle of winter?
And so your first book came out in 2017, and then your second one came out last year. And I haven't read it yet. I've got it ready to order. But I'm wanting to know what you've been doing in the years since then. Like, you've said you're living in Bulgaria.
Yeah. So we left New Zealand in 2017 after walking the Te Araroa Trail, the 3,000 kilometers through New Zealand. And we thought, wow, this walking is such a cool thing. We can do the same in Europe, because there are many different walkways in Europe, all starting with the E. So you got E1, E2, E3, and we walked the E4. And we started in France and walked into Switzerland and then Germany and then Austria. And then the weather was so foul that we thought, right, we're going to take a bus to Bulgaria. And we continue walking there because it's a bit warmer in September and October. So that's what we did. And then we walked another 500 kilometers through Bulgaria and Turkey as well before we came back to Australia and New Zealand. Yeah, so the second book is much about this journey. And on the way in Bulgaria, we saw a little cottage. And it cost so little money that we thought, wow, why not buy it? We might come back, may not. But it was 4 years later that we came back, which was last May.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Cool. So now you've been there since last May, because I've been very curious how COVID has affected your life.
Very little, actually, I must say. Honestly.
Yeah.
Well, New Zealand was all COVID-free until we left, basically. And here we live very far away from any big town, just a little village. Nobody is worried about COVID. There's plenty of COVID in Bulgaria, 3,000 cases a day or so, but no one is worried about it. They all talk about the bear, because the bear is much more dangerous than COVID here.
Yeah.
But then again, we are not in big cities and we avoid that, and yeah, we just live very quietly. But also maybe because we don't feel so right into society, I don't feel so, yeah, we don't have many obligations in that way, like most other people with work and that, I don't feel limited by the COVID restrictions, no.
Yes, yes, of course. And it doesn't, it doesn't influence your life really all that much. So, because I was wondering if, because you said you came there in May last year, so I'd wondering if it had played a part at all in your ability to travel to other countries and if you'd decided to head to Bulgaria for that reason.
Yes, indeed. We did. We could see that travel restrictions could increase in New Zealand. And so we thought, right, we go now. And the tickets were really cheap. And I think the tickets will go up. So, and suddenly I felt last year, for the first time in my life, that New Zealand was very far away from the rest of the world. And yeah, and that's when we said, oh, why not go back to our cottage that we have in Bulgaria? And we are on the Greek border. We're only 100 meters away from the border right here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so we can travel to Greece easily. Turkey is around the corner, Romania. And we'd like to explore more Central Asia. Georgia, Azerbaijan, Armenia. Yeah.
Oh, cool. So is that how you've been spending your time over the past like year or so while you've been there?
We've only been here since May. And since we arrived, we kept very quiet. No, we've just been in one place. We had a big vegetable garden over summer.
Nice,
and we get milk from the cow from a woman in the village. And we make yogurt. And we've been avoiding the bears. And picking lots and lots of fruits and nuts. So right now it's apple time, because the seasons are obviously different from New Zealand. And now it's apple time, and right around it's beautiful autumn colours.
Yeah, nice. And now you've mentioned bears a couple of times. Are they quite, are there quite a lot of bears around in the forest near you?
Yes, a lot. I walk around at all times with bear spray.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
They can be quite dangerous. There are some stories of bear attacks. Mm-hmm. Look, I'm not used to dangerous animals. I've no idea what to do if I see a bear. New Zealand is nothing.
No, nothing at all.
I'm rather scared. Yeah, very.
Now, do you see much of your own family in the Netherlands?
Well, my parents have immigrated to France. So I went to visit them last August, and both of my sisters who live in Sweden and also France also came to my parents. So it's the first time I saw them in 4 years.
Oh, wow. That would have been nice.
Great.
Yeah. Cool. Now, I will put links in the show notes to your website and your books. Where would you prefer people to buy them?
Well, they can order it on my website. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And they can buy it in any shop. Hopefully there's plenty of books left.
Yeah. Is there anywhere else we can send people who may like to hear more or to get in contact with you?
No, I only got the website. I don't have Facebook or Instagram.
Yeah, cool. And, you know, I have absolutely loved chatting with you today, Miriam. So thank you so much for hiking out to get reception just for us to connect. I really appreciate
you. Yes, well, my pleasure. Yeah. No, it's been great.
Yeah, I've loved hearing all your insights and experiences. Mm-hmm. My final question for you to end on is, if the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
If everything is lost, and so we'd be back in, say, the Dark Ages, then it would be really handy if us humans could reinvent iron. So I would never have thought of the idea of that iron is in a stone or a rock or something. So if I could leave one message for the next generation, is that I don't know how, but you can get iron out of a rock. Try long enough and you might find out how. Because having a spoon and a billy pot is super, super handy. And a knife.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.